Central Time. I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll meet two Irish filmmakers who are visiting Wisconsin for the first time, hear a little bit of their perspective on our state.
First, the Wisconsin legislature will take up a bill next week that could make Wisconsin what supporters call a right-to-work state.
The changes to union laws were thrown into the spotlight this morning when Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald announced plans to fast-track right-to-work legislation on a talk radio show. WPR's state capitol reporter Sean Johnson joins us now for the latest. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, what would a right-to-work law change here in the state?
What it would change is that it would ban mandatory union shops in the private sector. So right now, there are some union shops that you, or I guess some employers where you have to join a union in order to work there. And under the bill that they're going to advance next week, well, at the moment that I'm talking to you, I haven't looked at a copy of that that bill. It sounds like they're going to make that practice illegal. And so these unions could still exist, but it would be up to them to gather their members. They couldn't make that a requirement of working there.
Now, this bill hasn't been formally introduced, as you say, but Republican lawmakers say they've counted possible votes. The Senate could pass it by the end of next week. Why is this coming out now? And is there any indication of why it sounds like they're in a hurry to pass it?
This is something that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has sort of been flirting with ever since the election, when we found out that Republicans were going to have 19 seats in the state Senate and 63 seats in the state Assembly, and that the governor was going to be back in power. Fitzgerald said pretty soon after that election that he was looking into it. And he said today that he now knows that he has 17 firm commitments in the Senate, which is what you need to pass it there. So he doesn't have to wait for a special election for one of the seats to conclude. He has the votes now. And he says that when you have the votes, you move the bill. You don't wait around. He said he didn't want to wait around for unions to be able to launch kind of a counterattack and run TV ads in the districts of some of his members urging a no vote on this plan. So it's looking like there's going to be a committee hearing on Tuesday and the Senate's going to take it up on Wednesday.
So often when you get legislation like this, it gets drafted, released. There are public hearings, especially with major legislation. It seems like it often takes some time and they collect public input. How unusual is it for something like this to go so quickly?
This is what they wanted to do with Act 10, and obviously that got drawn out a lot longer. I mean, I remember when the governor introduced that, it was a Friday, and he said he was hoping the legislature would act on it by the next week. That didn't happen. There was a lengthy public hearing. Then the Senate Democrats fled, and because there's a requirement in the Constitution that you have to have a quorum of so many members present to vote on fiscal bills, they were able to block a vote on Act 10. And so that was a very lengthy debate. But there's no, we're told there's no such fiscal element to this bill. And so that makes it impossible for Democrats to block it in that way. It is a little weird to me talking to you here on a Friday, having not seen the bill. And it's going to be introduced on, there's going to be a public hearing on it on Tuesday. The Senate's going to pass it on Wednesday. So is it unusual, though, for a big issue like this to be negotiated in private behind closed doors to round up the votes before it's unveiled? That's not unusual.
Now, let's look at this from the governor's perspective. He has said in the past he wasn't going to push for right-to-work legislation, hasn't really said whether he'd sign it. What's the latest we're hearing from him?
He gave an unequivocal, I'll sign it today. I mean, you're right. The governor for years now has said, it's not going to reach my desk. It's not going to reach my desk. It's a non-issue. He said for several months that he didn't want legislative leaders to bring it up, thought it would be a distraction. I mean, repeatedly has not budged from that. And, I was just looking back at a story that we did in October of last year where a union leader said if Republicans win majorities, they're going to pass right to work. And, the governor said that that was absolutely false. Couldn't be further from the case. He has now completely changed his tune. And he said via his spokeswoman that he supports right to work as an issue. He did sponsor a right to work bill when he was a member of the legislature, and that if this reaches his desk, he will sign it.
Now, how have Democrats responded since this news came out this morning?
Their response has, almost to a member, been that right to work is going to hurt the middle class, that it's going to depress wages for everyone, and that that they're saying that the governor is using it as a distraction, that he knows it's going to be a distraction, and he's using it to distract from his own budget. And, you know, so they're saying that the governor's budget's not so popular, and so here he's doing this right to work law to distract from that. The governor is obviously running for president right now. He's trying to court conservative voters in Iowa, in New Hampshire. He's trying to court conservative donors, too, remember. So I think you have to look at any legislation through that lens and think that for a lot of those big donors especially, passing the right to work law is going to be seen as a positive.
Now, Republican leadership in the legislature, many of them, the members of it, of the legislature, have been talking about right to work for a while. Now, what's been their case for? You mentioned the Democrats' objections to it.
Their case for is that if you have a company that's considering where to locate, that company will look at right to work. They'll look to a state's union laws and Wisconsin's union laws in particular as a negative, and that a company trying to decide where to locate a plant will first choose a state that has a right to work law. So their argument is that this could be positive for the state, you know, down the road. I guess the flip side of that is one of the reasons it's beneficial to a company in terms of labor costs is that if you don't have a union there to negotiate for wages, then those labor costs are lower. People are paid less. Expect to hear some of that back and forth over the next couple weeks here.
Wisconsin is not the first state to tackle this issue. Do you have a sense of what the trend is nationwide on this issue?
Well, it looks like, you know, if this happens, we're going to be the 25th state that has what's referred to as a right to work law. In the past, you would have said that a lot of these right to work states are in the South or, you know, in the West. But, just recently, Michigan, a state with very strong union background, especially in the private sector, I mean, more of a union state than Wisconsin, Michigan just enacted a right to work law under a Republican governor and Republican legislative leadership. So it has happened near to us, and it looks like, you know, if everything goes through next week, and the week after that in the state assembly, it's going to happen in Wisconsin.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson about proposed right-to-work legislation. We'll be following this issue here on the Ideas Network over the course of the next couple of weeks.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Our next guests found themselves in Wisconsin all the way from Ireland after an invite to appear on the Wisconsin-produced web series Beer and Board Games.
John Hosier-Byrne and David Riley are co-founders of Stoneface Films. Together, they produced The Omega Male, which was screened at the Cannes Film Festival. They're also at work producing and writing music videos for the singer Hosier, who's John's older brother.
David Riley is a stand-up comedian and writer whose work has been featured on BBC. John, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's a joy. Thank you.
And David, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, neither of you guys has been to Wisconsin before, so what are a couple of respectable Irish comedians doing here in the Badger State, John?
Being very cold. It's very
sorry
cold.
About that.
No, it's lovely. It's an adventure. It's very cool. No, we are over here to play board games on YouTubes with the folks from Blame Society Films, who are very, very nice. And you'll be doing some comedy over here as well.
Hopefully we'll be doing a show one of the nights while I'm here, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be playing board games with Beer and Board Games is the name of the YouTube series.
Friday at 6.
Is that right? There you go. Friday, we're getting nods, so it's definitely Friday at 6.
Right, and it's produced here in Wisconsin. How did you end up hooking up with Beer and Board Games in Madison, Wisconsin?
I'm not really sure, but we're here now. Courtney Collins is a very talented producer who reached out to us, and we were like, we invited us to come over and to play board games on the internet while drinking, and we didn't really have any reason to say no to that. You know what I mean?
You'd be doing that anyway at home, right?
Yeah. Well, this is also the thing. So we were
it's just a case of there's a camera rolling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, So that's basically it. So that's why we're here, and it's great fun so far. We've really enjoyed it.
And I understand that you're bringing us a very special offering from Ireland to this special austere occasion, Beer and Board Games. What did you bring from Ireland?
We brought a rake of beer from a local brewery called Wicklow Wolf, which is sort of, I'm from Wicklow originally, which is sort of just south of Dublin in Ireland. And it's really, really nice stuff, and it's really sort of like limited. They only do a certain amount of this type of beer, and then a certain amount of that. Do you know what that is? Probably what the words are for what that is.
In the beer trade.
So it's cool, because as far as I'm aware, it's the first time it's been on American soil.
Yeah, that's what we were told.
Yeah, which is sort of nice. So they gave us loads of cool beer to bring over, which we did, stuffed in socks in our suitcase.
And it all got over. Yeah. It managed to all get through.
And we also brought over some Guinness that is based on...
It was a recipe they found in an old notebook from 1798. So they were like, yeah, so that's a Guinness recipe from 1798. So 200, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Maths aren't my thing.
Is this the Guinness recipe, the one that everyone, the iconic Guinness recipe beer?
I don't know.
It's a slight variation. So it would have been the, 1794? There's a big festival every year celebrating the founding of the Guinness Brewery, and they're trying to pretend it's a public holiday.
They made it up like three years ago.
Yeah, Arthur's Day. To the point that people call it St. Arthur's Day because they just presume it's a holiday. So this recipe, I think, was found in an old notebook somewhere in the brewery in Dublin, and they were like, let's just make this. So it's very old recipe, almost as old as America. So, on paper.
Well, you brought it to the right place. Wisconsinites are very, I don't know if you've picked up on this yet, but Wisconsinites are very attached to their beer along with their cheese, but the beer is right up there.
Absolutely.
So fair to say that's something Wisconsin has in common with Ireland, huh?
Certainly that is,
We do a mean cheese as well, though.
We do. We do like less badgers.
But
is that a weird thing? Was there like a lot of Irish people emigrating to Wisconsin?
There is actually a fairly strong Irish strand in Wisconsin. I think more so maybe in Milwaukee, but here in Madison there's some too. Yeah.
Because sometimes you can even get a little bit of the inflection when you're talking to people. It's a bit of an odd thing. It's sort of like there's some parts in Canada that just sound like Cork.
Yeah.
It's just like this really weird, strong Irish. So you can get a little bit of the inflection. But yeah, no, definitely drinking and cheese are they're the dream. That's the big two.
We're living the dream in Wisconsin and Ireland, apparently.
Yeah.
So, John, the two of you, aside, you know, we're not drinking and playing board games, you direct and produce music videos, including some with your brother.
That's right.
Hozier. And I'm curious, what have you been working on for him right now?
Well, the next video that comes out, it's not the next single out over here. It's the next single out in Europe. But it will be the next music video out, is for a song called Someone New, which is really fun. And we got to, me and David wrote it, and it was directed by a fella called Anthony Byrne, who does a lot of work with, like...
He directed some of the Tudors and those sort of periods.
Ripper Street and stuff
Ripper
like
Street,
that.
Things like that.
Yeah, he's a fantastic director, really, really cool guy. And we got to work with him, and that's a public knowledge thing we can say.
It is, yeah. The sort of star of the video is Natalie Dormer from The Tudors and Game of Thrones and Hunger Games. So we had to work with her on the shoot, which was great.
Does she play Daenerys?
She's Marjorie Tyrell.
Okay.
Out of the Games of Thrones.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
She was Anne Boleyn in The Tudors.
Nice. Well, is it fun getting to boss your big brother? He's your big brother.
No, he's my little brother, actually.
Your little brother.
We're what's actually referred to as Irish twins. We're like, 18 months apart, 20 months
apart.
So he's just a bit younger than me. But he doesn't get bossed, really. There's no boss in Andy. It was great, though. It was fantastic to be able to work with him. And to Andy's credit, I think it's fantastic the way he's worked with the family as a whole, because my mother did his album cover. My mother's an artist, and she drew his album or painted his album cover, and my dad recorded some of the vocals for like the album and stuff. And it's great that we've had the opportunity to write the video and do something a bit bit odd and a bit out there, so it'll be. I'm really excited to see what people think when it comes out.
Can you tell us at all about what's odd and out there about it? Now that you mentioned that, I'm curious.
Kind of. It's just a bit. What could I say about it? It's just a bit more. David?
You're doing lots of hand gestures.
Hand gestures for the radio.
Translate well.
It's just a bit out there, and it's a bit. Hopefully, it will be sort of a video people can watch on more than one occasion and get different things from it.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting. I think it's definitely.
So you don't want to say too much because it could give away.
Yeah, I don't want to give elements away or
yeah.
whatever.
It's sort of, I guess, the general theme of the video is just, you know, like in a sense, I guess, female independence or sort of how. Yeah, it's hard to explain it without giving away the sting.
No, it was definitely
we'll have to watch
from the start. It was definitely a very actively consciously a feminist text.
Yeah.
So I think even I suppose that alone in the context of 90% of music videos that are coming out now is different in and of itself, right? So it's really great to be able to work on something that will have a big reception.
Hopefully,
certainly. We never know. No one, it might be shite. But we like it so far. We're very happy with how it's gone.
And two of you are comedians alongside your work shooting music videos. Does that ever find its way into the music videos that you do too?
Well, David would be a lot more actively comic than I would.
Been doing stand-up 6 years today. Did my first gig 6 years ago today.
Congratulations. It's an anniversary.
So I made it, Ma. I'm in Wisconsin.
I've got some bad news for you.
What? This isn't where the comedy story is. It's like when we're writing things, we'll always try to put a humorous take on it, put our own sort of style on it. Even if it's like we'll write this sort of a more of a dramatic or serious piece, we'll always try to put a bit of a surreal twist on the humor. Yeah. Just so there's a bit, it's laced there with our sort of sense of humor.
I can't really get away with writing serious things. Like when I was a teenager, I really wanted to get a collection of berets and like turtlenecks and stuff and just weep uncontrollably while smoking. Like that was very much my idea of what, you know, and the aesthetic of like a serious
artist. Jean-Paul Sartre.
Exactly. I just really wanted to be terrifically French. But I'm not at all. And anything I write that attempts to be serious always ends up being a bit stupid and a bit silly. And that's okay.
Because
that sort of works out well. And it's worked out well enough for us so far. Because we sort of. Like, for example, we had a film in the Cannes Film Festival the summer just gone.
Just last festival, yeah.
Yeah, and it was meant to be all sort of serious and stuff and meant to have, like, a serious point and stuff. But then, like, when we're writing it, that's the intentionality going in. And then when you actually make it, it's like, oh, we forgot the scene where there's a dude shopping in the Nip in a supermarket.
It's very gonzo. We just sort of rocked in.
Oh, a Nip in the Nip. Is that an expression you have here?
It's not. I'm surmising it means what, in the buff?
Yes, right, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So yeah,
far from buff, but in the buff. We rocked up to a supermarket we knew was open in the middle of the night. It was myself, John, our cameraman, the star of the film, and a few other guys that we needed to just keep an eye on where the security guards and staff were, and we just went in. One shot, just dropped the coat.
It was genuinely terrifying.
It was really sketch.
We did a similar enough one actually on the same shoot because the plot of that one is that he's like the last dude in Dublin because everyone else
emigration's a huge thing in Ireland at the moment. Especially our generation has decided to leave. So either to America or England or Australia, much like in the 80s and the 1880s, the whole Irish thing of leaving, but
and coming to Wisconsin, presumably.
You might be starting in a second wave, third wave, whatever it is. So is the name of this film?
That was called The Omega Male. And there was one other shot in it that we had, like, because he was naked on top of St. Pat's Cathedral.
It's a very old
Dublin.
Church.
Yeah,
it's like a 600-year-old cathedral in Dublin.
Yeah. Huge spires going up. And we booked it sort of like a tour almost. And we're going up this big spire and walking up these like monastery-style steps for ages and ages and ages. And we were knackered getting about halfway up.
Very tired, that means.
That means very tired. Thank you. And by the time we got about halfway up, the guy was sort of talking to us. about all the various facets of the church and stuff. And we were like, when we get to the top, is it cool if, you know, our star just gets naked and we film him on the top of the cathedral? He's like, not really. Like, yeah, but we're nearly there now and it'd take you ages to get back
yeah,
down.
Go on.
And
fine.
Get security.
So you two are basically kicked out of Ireland is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, now that we've left, we'll see how it is getting back in. Mm-hmm. That could be the challenge.
Well, I hope you guys have fun in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been great.
That was John Hosier-Byrne and David Riley, the co-founders of Stoneface Films in Ireland. They're in Wisconsin to appear in the locally produced web series Beer and Board Games.
I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listen to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, winter is still happening, and the temperatures have been bitterly cold for the last week or so.
Keeping with our Winter Food Friday themes, we asked regular guest Lori Skelton to take on a big assignment, chili. For the last few weeks, she's been cooking up all different kinds of chili. She's here to share what she's learned along the way.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you have a favorite chili recipe? And what do you think are the essential ingredients for chili? Lots of people have a secret ingredient, maybe chocolate, tortilla chips, crazy stuff, peaches. What is yours? What do you think it takes to make a chili? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is a Food Friday regular, one of our in-house foodies here at WPR. Lori, welcome back.
This was a good one to come back on.
This is a lot of fun. Well, you know, here's a complicated question that I didn't know was a complicated question. How do we define chili?
That is a complicated question. When you go back to where it first got started in the American consciousness, you do have the cowboys, the cattle drives. What the camp cooks used to do is they would take dried meat and pound it with suet, with onions, and with dried chili peppers. They'd take that concoction, dry it into bricks, and then have that to boil into chili along the trails. And this has been a debate pretty much for the last month. What is chili? There are Malcolm Brett insists that chili doesn't even have tomatoes in it. It is just that beef, onions, peppers, maybe some herbs, and that's it. I know one Facebook friend of mine mentioned that his family recipe is still called chili brick. They put together the peppers and the meat ahead of time and then freeze it and then pull that base out of the freezer and then add other stuff to it. When you started adding things like corn or especially beans, Eric Ajanek told me that's a result of the World Wars, when you were encouraged to find things that were going to stretch the meal when you didn't have as much meat. And for some people, when I talked to them in this last month, they insisted that chili has to have those added things in it. And when I said, why? What's the culinary history? They said, there's no history. That's just what I grew up eating. And so this is a dish that people do get very, very passionate about. Whatever the history of the food is in terms of America, or even before that, say, Columbus showed up, I know that there is evidence that the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayans had mixtures of beef and beans and some sort of pepper long before Columbus showed up.
But the beans are kind of contentious, right? Because not everybody thinks that beans belong in chili, which blew my mind. I thought that was, you know, what chili was.
That does seem to start with Texas. And then the San Antonio chili queens, they were the first ones to start selling chili by the bowl. And they did not have beans in theirs. The San Antonio chili stand at the 1893 Columbian Exposition in Chicago, no beans in that chili. Beans are pretty much a 20th century addition. And so there are a lot of people, especially if you're from Texas, who say that if it has beans in it, it ain't chili. Then again, there are some people who say that if you serve it over macaroni, it ain't chili. There are some people who say that if you don't have an animal protein in it, it's not chili. There are some people who say vegetarian chili ain't chili. For me, chili is about the seasoning rather than the other ingredients in it. I love a fair amount of heat. I also love a fairly strong flavor. I tended to use more chili powder than what was called for in the recipes I tested this month, and I usually add some kind of fresh chili as well, fresh pepper as well, be it green pepper or jalapeno, poblano, anchos. I'll find some way to get that in there as well.
Well, you announced your presence with authority in this project. You pushed the envelope as far as you possibly could. The first one was a fruit chili.
I thought this was a joke, but somebody had mentioned that they'd had a chili with fruit in it, and the first thing I Googled fruit chili, the first thing that came up was something on the Tabasco brand website. They call it Caribbean fruit chili, and they start off with fruit juice. They suggest things like peach or orange or papaya or pineapple, and then you put in cubes of fruit, like strawberries and mango and pineapple. After you have simmered your chili powder and your garam masala in that fruit juice, then you add your fruit and you add some coconut milk and you add a lot of Tabasco and some brown sugar and lime and just a little bit of tequila. And I tried it thinking, well, this is okay. I'm going to take this into work and everybody's going to laugh me off seventh floor. Everybody loved it. Everybody loved it. My favorite suggestion came from Ann Strainchamps on To the Best of Our Knowledge. She called it refreshing. She said it would be a great thing to include with brunch. I'll give her that. I am not the biggest Bloody Mary fan, but I can see the merit of having something cool and spicy at the same time when you're having a late brunch meal. And yeah, I think this actually would be a really nice addition on a Sunday morning brunch table.
I missed that one. I don't know how. It's not cool that I missed it. It sounds like it was really interesting, but does that one stand up as an entree? Would you sit down to have a bowl of that with a piece of cornbread, or is it sort of its own animal?
I could see having a small bowl of that alongside your scrambled eggs or your omelet. I could definitely see having that with a sweeter dough. I don't know if I'd go cornbread, but there are recipes out there for lighter cornmeal muffins or biscuits that have like raisins or currants in. This would be an amazing accompaniment to that.
All right, well, let's go to the polar opposite now. Fruit chili to, you made it all beef, no beans chili. So where's this recipe from?
If you're going to go no beans, you got to go Texas. And for years, everyone was asking Lady Bird Johnson for her chili recipe, to the point that the White House, while the Johnsons were in office, had cards printed up with Mrs. Johnson's recipe on it, what she called the Pedernales River Chili. This was 4 pounds of ground meat, onion, garlic, oregano, cumin, chili powder, canned whole tomatoes, hot sauce, water, and salt. I thought this was the most boring chili I've ever made.
I was going to say, if you ever open a restaurant, you actually said, I don't like this chili. You guys might not like it either. Get a marketing person if you ever open a restaurant.
Well,
that wasn't a real good sales job.
Again, everybody loved it. But this was one chili I thought was really, really interesting. Almost all the time, somebody would take a bite and pronounce it delicious and then immediately say, what could I put this on? Mm-hmm. This was not something that people looked at as on its own, as an entree on its own. It's like, okay, I'd use this in my tacos, or I'd put this on a Coney dog, or I want this on macaroni, or...
Right, I was just going to say, it sounds just like my grandparents' recipe, which I thought was a little too essentialist for me. It was boiled down to its purest possible state, but they always served it on spaghetti noodles.
They served it on spaghetti. You suggested garlic bread?
Like our garlic bread or Texas toast, I thought it'd be really good on, yeah.
And it certainly would, but here again, if you're like if you're somebody especially who's used to having beans or other vegetables or something in it, this may strike you as a little bit austere, and you're going to want to have something with it. But again, if you're from Texas, this really is where you come from.
And you also made a pork chili, and this is a red pork chili. Tell us a little bit about what went into that one.
I've made pork chilies before, always with a green accompaniment. Tomatillas, milder green chilies, some kind of salsa verde is going to go with pork. So I was very surprised to find from Gourmet Magazine about 15 years ago a red pork and bean chili. You start off by sautéing bacon, and then taking your 4 pounds of pork shoulder, cubing it, not grinding it, and sautéing it in the bacon fat. One of the things that this particular chili had in the mix was a cup of strong brewed coffee, in addition to the beans and the jalapenos and the garlic and all the good things you throw in there. I tasted this chili about 15 minutes after it started to simmer. This was a chili that, after a short amount of cooking time, already had the level of flavor complexity that most chilies only attain when they've been bubbling on the stove for a couple of hours and when they've sat for a day. So one thing I'm going to keep at the back of my mind, whether or not I'm making this particular pork chili, if you need to boost flavor in something, think about adding some coffee. That really seemed to do a lot for adding the flavor. This was probably my favorite chili of the entire experiment. I've never had a red pork chili before, and I'm in love with this.
We're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about a lot of different twists on chili.
And we're taking your calls right now. Well, how do you define chili? We've been finding out about a different expectations. Some say no beans, some say beans, some say it's got to have meat. What do you think? What does it take to make chili? And what is your secret ingredient? Coffee, maybe? Tortilla chips, chocolate? Let us know. And what do you like to put on it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up this discussion and check out a recipe we have on the Facebook page after a look at the news with Noah Ovshinsky. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Lori Skelton about chili on this Food Friday.
And we're taking your calls. What is your favorite kind of chili? What's the secret ingredient that makes it awesome that you gotta have in it? What's the best chili you've ever had? What is chili? How do you define it? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a recipe for Twisted Sisters chili we'll get to in just a moment here on the air. That's posted on the Facebook page. First, we'll go to a caller. We've got Chad on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Chad.
How are you?
Good. What do you got for us in the chili department?
First of all, I don't think modern chili is chili without tomato juice. That's a key ingredient. I use about 5 or 6 different meats in my chili, and with the ground beef, I cook it with taco seasoning first and then throw it in the pot. And I also use tender cuts of red meats, maybe a tenderloin. I'll cube that up and throw it in too.
Let me be clear, Chad. Are you talking you make 5 or 6 different kinds of chili with their own meat, or your one batch of chili has 5 or 6 different kinds of meat in it?
One batch of chili with 5 or 6 different meats.
Okay, I heard 2. Ground meat. Okay.
Ground beef or ground turkey. Some kind of ground sausage. We'll use Italian sausages. We'll use the tenderloin, cubed beef or stew meat. Basically anything.
Wow.
Anything we have in the fridge.
Chad, thanks a lot. So he's going a lot of different meats, probably a lot of rich, varied flavor there, Laurie.
And I'm intrigued by the idea of taco seasoning, because the taco seasonings I'm used to are going to be a little bit sweeter than a chili powder blend. And I'm also very intrigued when he says tomato is key, because something like the chicken chili I tried didn't have tomatoes in it. Texas chili may not have tomatoes in it, but for some, the acidity is needed. That's interesting.
Well, thanks a lot for that. And I guess for people who don't want to put 5 or 6 kinds of meat in their chili, there is a vegetarian option that you explored. And this one, I would have said you were getting a little too crazy, Lori. I would have said, Lori, dial it down.
Okay.
Peaches and chili, but you did it, and it was amazing.
You saw the Super Bowl ad where Budweiser said, we didn't make a pumpkin peach beer, and then Abita came back a week later and said, yeah, we made a pumpkin peach beer and it was pretty good. I got inspired to see, is it possible to do some kind of pumpkin peach chili? I found pumpkin chili recipes on the internet, but they were all calling for pureed pumpkin. I wanted to see if I could find something that was using cubes of fresh pumpkin. Actually, I couldn't find fresh pumpkin at this point, but I did use butternut squash, corn, and beans, which is the three sisters in agriculture and cooking. And I let that simmer for an hour, and then I added some bags of frozen peaches. I was amazed. I thought, again, people are going to laugh at me. There are carnivores on WPR staff who were telling me I didn't miss the meat with this.
No, you didn't.
It was a good, sturdy veggie chili, and then that kick of sweet with the peaches just made everybody delighted.
Well, in doing something like this without meat, I think one of the big concerns is always, where's the texture going to come from? And that's, I guess, where the squash came in?
It's one of the reasons why I wanted to use cubes of the vegetable rather than a pumpkin puree. I do think you need some texture. I like having something to chew.
It was a little, you like it spicy. So this one was spicy, but it did just fine with some sour cream on top. So it wasn't too far. It wasn't as crazy as it sounded, I guess. It still tasted like a traditional but different chili.
And this is the recipe we've got on the Facebook page. And if you don't want it so spicy, dial back on the amount of chili powder you use. Maybe dial back on the amount of poblanos you put in. Maybe skip the can of chili and adobo. And then put your peaches in later to simmer so that they'll even taste fresher.
That's Twisted Sisters Chili. We've got it on the Central Time Facebook page as we talk chili on Food Friday with Lori Skelton. We'll go to the phones again. And Lisa is with us in Appleton. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My mom grew up during the Depression years, and they always in the family added spaghetti noodles and cubed potato. And I just talked to the only living relative yet, her sister, and she said the potatoes were really just to cut the acidity of the tomatoes. So for whatever that's worth, that's how our family did it.
Interesting, Lisa. Thanks. So another, as with the beans, the potatoes, well, the noodles were there to maybe stretch it out during the Depression, but potatoes to cut the acidity.
And yet they still felt the flavor of the tomato needed to be in there. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? You could have just omitted the tomatoes, but this is someone who wanted that balance.
Right. Well, that's an interesting one. Have you heard of that before?
I've never heard of potatoes in chili. But then again, I tend to shy away from the macaroni, the spaghetti end of it. I tend to like my chili with just beans and corn being the carbs in there. Normally, I'd say yes on pasta and potatoes, but this is one time where I back off.
Bit of a purist on this one, Lori.
Oh, yeah.
After all we've talked about, yeah. Nat, you're a purist. Okay.
Okay.
I had to call you out on something. All right. Well, thank you, Lisa. Appreciate that. Potatoes. And let's go next to David in Sparta. Hi, David.
Hey. Good afternoon. Pasta has no place in anybody's chili.
Here we go.
I use, my favorite is venison, shredded venison, not ground. It just doesn't have the right texture if you use ground meat of any sort. But just, and chipotle peppers, and just keep throwing stuff in until it tastes right. And let it sit overnight.
I do think most chili does benefit from letting the flavors talk to one another. I wasn't able to make a venison chili this time around, but I've had venison chili in the past, and you're right. There is something about that assertive cut of meat that is just amazing with chipotle.
Are you starting to feel like that there's nothing you can't put in chili? I'm starting to feel like you can put anything in it.
I guess it depends on where you come from, what your chili background is. Like I say, a month ago, I wouldn't have thought that fruit chili would have worked. And
now you're a believer.
I don't know as I'd have it for every meal, but it's nice to have it in the arsenal.
Definitely.
All right, back to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. So as a former vegetarian for years and years who went back to the Wisconsin lifestyle of eating venison, I'll give you my veggie recipe for chili. And what I did is your standard chili, but in order to add the meat-type aspect back into it, I take the large portobello mushrooms, the big ones that are 6-8 inches in diameter, so you get thick cubes, and come into about 3/4-inch cubes, and I marinate them overnight first in like a teriyaki sauce mixed with a little Worcestershire sauce and lots of cardamom and a little bit of taco seasoning. marinate those overnight, and then I add those into the chili at the very last minute, about a half hour before I'm going to serve it. Just enough to heat up the mushrooms and make them slightly soft, but it still gives you that chewy chunk of meat feeling, and with the cardamom and the teriyaki.
Where did you come up with cardamom? That is brilliant.
Oh, cardamom is my biggest secret for my meat chili. Mm. For my meat chili, my two secret ingredients for my venison chili is lots of cardamom and my secret starter base, which is spicy V8.
Wow. Mm. Well, the secrets are out there. Cardamom.
Oh, man.
I like the mushroom, the portobello mushroom idea, too, though. That's got the texture, and then with that teriyaki, that's going to give it a different kind of tang,
too. Yeah, that surprises me. Can you see that, Lori?
I was not expecting the cardamom, but listening to this, I got to get back in the kitchen this weekend.
I could tell you were having a moment there. Mm-hmm. You sat up straight in your chair.
That really sounds amazing.
Right.
I love using French four spice, which is cardamom and white pepper and a few other things, but I never would have thought in chili. Wow.
All right. Well, we'll expect another batch in the next couple of days. Lori, thank you so much for your hard work. You made a lot of chilies. They're all really good.
Absolutely. Glad to share it.
That's Lori Skelton. She's a Food Friday regular and one of our in-house foodies here on WPR. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Still interested in hearing your take. What has to be in chili? What should never be in chili? And how do you make it? And while you're there, you can find Lori's recipe for the Twisted Sisters chili. That's one of the veggie options. Could probably mix a little meat in if you wanted to as well to really make it pop. You can find that all over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, tell us about those secret ingredients. We've heard about coffee, cardamom. What else do you think belongs in chili and gives it that little kick? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
A lot of us are looking for signs of spring on this cold winter day. Well, here's one. It is pitcher catcher day for the Milwaukee Brewers. It's the first day that players report for some spring training. Today's high temperature, maybe close your ears if you don't want to hear it. Today's high temperature in Phoenix, Arizona, home of the spring camp, 80 degrees.
That's not fair.
Yeah.
Isn't Central Time supposed to be doing live broadcasts from that camp for maybe the next 4 weeks?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get on that. Hop on the plane. I'm sure we can get the technology over. No, I don't think it's going to happen. Maybe next.
Beautiful
maybe
idea.
Maybe next year.
If we're still, if we're de-thawed by then.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so also today in baseball, this would have been the 95th birthday of Carl E. Stotts, the man who invented Little League Baseball. He started a three-team league in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. It's grown a bit since then. According to the Little League website, it's now in 80 countries worldwide with more than 2.4 million children playing in Little League each year.
Well, I'm a little inspired. I may have to break out the gloves this weekend, make the kids go outside, throw the ball around.
Yeah.
I'll tell them it builds character. That works every time.
I think that only works if you're in Arizona.
Yeah, probably so. Well, maybe a couple months. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.